From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Super Tuesday is upon us, and Massachusetts voters are at the polls.
I voted for Bernie. I considered a few candidates, but I guess I like his ideas.
I voted for Biden because Buttigieg dropped out.
I voted for Elizabeth Warren. I really like the policies that she stands for.
It's a pretty different primary landscape than it was even just 2 days ago. We'll get analysis and take your calls on the rapid consolidation behind Joe Biden and what it means for the presidential race. And
we all have in the back of our minds being prepared for a snowstorm. We have to be prepared for public health emergencies as well.
Got questions about the coronavirus? Call us with them. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is Super Tuesday. 14 states and one territory head to the polls today, either to vote in presidential primaries or participate in a caucus. That is 1,357 delegates at stake on this day. On the Democratic side, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, former Vice President Joe Biden, New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, and Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard are all still in the race for the Democratic nomination. But polling indicates that the tightest race in Massachusetts will be between Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. Secretary of the Commonwealth Bill Gavin says turnout is as strong as he had hoped for so far. He's still predicting that 1.5 million voters will turn out, which would be about 300,000 more than 4 years ago. Here's just some of what WBUR has been hearing from voters today.
Yeah, it was a tough choice for me between Bernie and Elizabeth Warren. I ended up going for Bernie just because I think he has stronger stances.
I've been supporting Elizabeth Warren for like many, many months, so it's kind of like not much of a choice for me today.
I voted for Bernie. He says it like it is. Maybe like a few things I don't agree with, but he says it like it is, and he's more down to earth with the voters.
I'm going for Biden. I think he has the best chance of defeating Trump.
Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld is the only Republican mounting a challenge to President Trump. I want to turn now to WBUR's Simone Rios, who's also been out at polling locations today. He joins us from our Dorchester Bureau at the Dorchester Reporter. Hey there, Simone.
Hey, Tiziana.
So you went out to the polling place today at Harbor Point Apartments on Mount Vernon Street in Dorchester. And Simone, you found voters concerned about access to the polls. Can you tell us about what happened and what you found?
Yeah, it was really astounding. I mean, there were a number of issues. Actually, I count five total problems that I heard about. It really raised by the poll workers who were irate at a number of things that were happening. Early in the morning, the tabulation machine went down. The Elections Commission had to come in and fix it. There was a problem with the phone lines later in the day. There was apparently construction happening outside the poll, and caution tape had been put up across the steps, all these things. And then to top it all off, the company – so let me just set the scene. Harbor Point is an affordable housing development owned by a private company, Corker & Jennison, and somebody made the decision to ask for IDs of people going in to vote. So I actually had a hard time getting in myself as a reporter, and I had to explain that it's the law that this is – it might be private property, but this is a public polling location, and we have access as journalists. So I had to go back and forth with them. I finally got in, and it turns out that they were – asking all the voters for their ID. What's unclear is whether anybody, you know, didn't go in and vote as a result of this, which I think would be a critical issue. The Elections Commission, the Boston Elections Commission, got involved and apparently spoke to management, who reversed course and stopped asking for ID of voters. And then we heard from the Secretary of State's office, who said it's illegal to impede people's access to polling locations. Another person I spoke to about this was Patty Comfort. She's the executive director of the League of Women Voters of Massachusetts.
I can imagine some people showing up because they vote all the time, you know, without their wallet or that kind of thing, and then they can't get into the building. So that's a problem.
Simone, that does sound... Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say that this is one thing I didn't talk about. There is a 7-story building across the street from this polling location within the same Harbor Point development. The elevator has been broken apparently for 4 days. And so there's something like 69 residents there, according to one of the poll workers, who said that many of them, you know, they couldn't come down and vote because the elevator was broken. I talked to one gentleman who had come down with 2 security guards on a cane, walked down 6 flights of stairs to vote, and the poll officials told me that he was the only one from that building.
Wow. It sounds like that was a challenge for a lot of voters in that area. Simone, I've got about 30 seconds left with you. What issues did you hear from voters today were most important out there?
You know, at this place in Dorchester, certainly just the act of
access.
Voting itself,
yeah.
Was
good point.
Was a pretty key issue, but I think it's oftentimes the things we hear about are housing, healthcare. Did I say housing? Seems to be on everybody's minds out here. The common things that you would think about, but the gentleman I told you about who had to go down 6 flights didn't share who he voted with me.
So that is WBUR reporter Simone Rios with some interesting stories from Dorchester Day today. Simone, thanks.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we're going to check in with some other reporters throughout this hour from around Massachusetts, and we want to start out west. Jill Kaufman is a reporter with New England Public Radio. She joins us from Amherst, and she's been out to Sunderland, Shutesbury, and New Salem in Massachusetts today. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
So I know you traveled around several rural towns in your part of the state. Can you kind of characterize where you were today and what the mood was out there, Jill?
Sure. It's so different out here listening to Simone's description of what's been happening in some places in Boston. It is a gorgeous spring-like day here. I think mud season began today. I landed in something earlier. 60 degrees, easy access, and a constant flow of people coming and going in these very small towns. 2 of the towns that I was in earlier today are under 2,000 people each, and a mix. Age, you know, elders, 40-somethings. I met some 20-somethings as well. We are in the Connecticut River Valley. One of the towns I went to this morning was the town of Sunderland, and that's not far from UMass Amherst, where I'm sitting now. So, again, a constant flow at 8 a.m. at the library where the voting takes place, and among the crowd was Craig Tiedemann, who, funny enough, had just moved to Sunderland last summer with his family from Boston.
Small world.
Votes in every, in Brighton, and he said the parking out here is really easy. I didn't tell him about the tractors one can get stuck behind, but he votes in every election, he says, and it's really, you know, important to do that, but especially so this year, he said, and that has to do with getting a Democrat in the White House for him, and in less genteel terms, he said, you know, the reason he came out was to beat Donald Trump, and he voted for Joe Biden.
He's not a perfect candidate, in my opinion, by any stretch, but to me, the most important thing is the ability to beat Trump, and I don't know that he has that, but in my judgment, I think he has the best chance, given the experience.
So that's a Biden supporter, Jill. I think we're all trying to get a handle on where this vote's going to go. Was there a lot of support for one candidate out there today, or was the vote pretty split?
Well, my, you know, exit polling is completely inaccurate, unofficial.
Unscientific, right?
Unscientific, at least. There are a lot of, apparently, you know, by signage, there's a lot of Sanders supporters here in what we call Hampshire County. A lot of signage, you know, and this is also Elizabeth Warren's territory, right? Bernie Sanders was in Boston Friday. I'm sorry, he was in Springfield Friday night, a block away from where Elizabeth Warren has her office in this area on Main Street in Springfield. It's unclear what will happen, of course, as you well know. I did meet one wonderful couple, 42 years of marriage. They met in Europe during the war. She's German, he's American. She's American now, she told me. They live in the town of New Salem, which if you jumped in your car from there to Cambridge, to Alewife, it's about an hour on Route 2. They've been married a long time. They don't always vote the same, but this time they did.
I voted for Bloomberg. I think he talks right. He don't spread all the hate around. You know, we don't need more hate. We need more get together.
It's great to have.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's Joanna Riddell. I'm sorry. I didn't tell you who she was. Excuse me.
That's okay. We're glad to have heard from her, and it's good to sort of get a sense for where the vote is going out in that part of the state. That's Jill Kaufman, a reporter with New England Public Radio, joining us from Amherst. Thanks for taking the time, Jill.
Thank you so much.
All right. So the available choices in today's primary are really different than they were this time last week. In fact, over a period of about 48 hours from Saturday to Monday, it seems like pretty much everything changed in the Democratic primary. That's when Joe Biden won South Carolina by big numbers.
And if the Democrats want a nominee who's a Democrat, yeah! A lifelong Democrat, a proud Democrat, an Obama-Biden Democrat, join us.
Well, join him they did. Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar dropped out of the race Sunday and Monday. And then Buttigieg, Klobuchar, and former candidate Beto O'Rourke all endorsed Joe Biden in Texas last night. Senator Bernie Sanders isn't backing down from that show of force.
And let me be very clear. It is no surprise. They do not want me to become president because our administration will transform this country to create an economy and a government that works for all of the people, not just the 1%. It will not be the same old, same old.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren isn't dropping out either. So, pretty big shift in a very short period of time. How and why? And what does it mean? Let's get some help sorting that out. We've got Boston Globe political reporter James Pindle here with us in Studio 3. James, thanks for being with us.
Have a Super Tuesday.
Super Tuesday. And joining us from the WBUR Dorchester Bureau is Bill Forey, editor and publisher of the Dorchester Reporter. Is it a Super Tuesday for you, Bill?
So far, Super Tuesday all the way.
There you go. And are you, listeners, as curious as we are? Do you have theories about what happened in the last couple of days? Is it good or bad for the Democratic Party? And who do you see as the front runner now? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right, gentlemen, it feels like a lot of change really fast. Bill, is it?
Yes. The ground's changed here a bit. What we're watching for locally in Dorchester and Mattapan is to see just how is this going to affect the vote for Elizabeth Warren in particular, and for Joe Biden, and for Bernie Sanders. Sanders in 2016 did fairly well in Boston. He won about 41% of the vote in the city, even though he lost to Hillary Clinton. He won a number of precincts in that year in Dorchester, in places like Savin Hill and in Neponset. So we'll be watching carefully tonight to see what those numbers say. How well can Joe Biden do in places like Neponset, where he would traditionally do well in a neighborhood like that? We're going to be watching those vote totals come in carefully.
What about you, James? What do you think?
Look, tonight's going to solve some three related questions. After tonight, are we going to have a one-person race, a two-person contest, or a three-person contest? And if it's a three-person contest, who is that third person? I think a lot of us accept the premise that right now we are headed towards something like a Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, maybe a two-person contest. Maybe Sanders crushes it tonight. But who's in third? Is it exactly Mike Bloomberg? That's a lot of people think. But I think there's a compelling argument that at the end of tonight, we could be shocked and find ourselves that Elizabeth Warren is that third person.
Why do you say that?
Well, look, this thing is, as candidates get out of the race, obviously it helps everyone still in the race. In her particular case, Amy Klobuchar got out of the race. She was the only other woman in this contest. It is now consolidated support for those folks who want to see a woman on the ticket, not just two straight white guys, or in this case, three straight white guys, if you include Mike Bloomberg, old straight white guys, by the way. And second, Pete Buttigieg, you know, if you're going to tell me that Buttigieg's support goes 50% for Biden and 50% for Warren, I would not be shocked. I mean, after all, they do share a base of educated white liberal voters. So in that case, this could be a pretty good night for Elizabeth Warren in a way that people may not predict. But obviously, what we're going to be watching here is how big is the delicate net gain for Bernie Sanders tonight. It could be huge. It could be not huge, and that's obviously going to set the table here. But it's obviously going to be a good night for him.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Gwen, you are on with Bill Foree and James Pindle. Gwen's calling from Cambridge. Go ahead.
Hey, I just wanted to say, on this show just a moment ago, and I was happy to hear Elizabeth Warren mentioned by the analyst, but show after show after show, on NPR, on TV, all over, I hear this throwaway line, Elizabeth Warren's still in the race. If she's mentioned at all, it's just she's still in the race. And no discussion of the fact that only 3% of the delegates have been allocated so far, and it's crazy to talk about front runners and winners, and Joe Biden, after winning one state when she beat him in two states, that it's a done deal. It's not a done deal. We, the voters, have a right to have our say and vote.
Thank you for that, Gwen. I'm going to add one more call, and then we'll come back to our panelists. We've got Dave on the line from Malden. Dave, you're on. What's on your mind?
Sure. I want to just add to that point that we, the voters, do decide, but the DNC doesn't seem to like that. And so Buttigieg and Klobuchar, it just seems like they're going along endorsing Joe Biden. And you'll call them all fringe, but it just seems like ass-kissing, and that's how the DNC rolls.
Dave, we're gonna move on to our panelists here. Let me start with Bill Foree and the first call. What about this idea that Elizabeth Warren is getting discounted when most of the race is still yet to happen?
Right. Well, listen, we're not discounting anything until we see these numbers come in tonight. But I will say that, you know, this is a high stakes day for her. This is Warren country where I'm at right now. Traditionally, going back to 2012, she won 80% of the city, 83% of the Dorchester vote, 96% of the Mattapan vote in 2012. But that was against Scott Brown. In 2018, her big wins here, 80%. Win in Boston was over Jeff Deal. She won everything but one precinct in my neighborhood. But this is a different field, and Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders both will not perform at Jeff Deal level. Just how much attrition we'll see into the Warren country here is to be seen. But I did talk to voters today who were moved, for example, by Amy Klobuchar. I talked to one voter, a retired Boston police officer, who said he was going to vote for Klobuchar and now is having to make up his mind and was influenced by her endorsement of Joe Biden last night. So with this kind of dynamic and fluidity in this race, I think there's every reason to believe, and also by poll numbers, WBUR's most recent poll was indicated that Warren was behind Sanders. So it's a high-stakes day for her. She really does have to win her home state, in my view, to continue on.
So, James, what about the other call on that expression of sort of distrust of Joe Biden, or this sense that, boy, this happened really fast, and are we sure this is the guy? You know, it did happen fast. There was just a bam, bam from Saturday morning to today. Other candidates coalesced or condensed behind Biden. But what about the electorate?
I'm a reporter. I share the skepticism of anyone who has skepticism. And I also share the amount of whiplash that we all just had in the last 48 hours. At the same time, if you want to listen to go back to the tape of what Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar and I don't even know exactly what Beto O'Rourke has been saying in the last couple of weeks. But if you look at what Buttigieg and Klobuchar have been saying after debate after debate after debate, it's entirely consistent with what they did last night in Dallas when they endorsed Joe Biden. They do not believe that Bernie Sanders is someone who can win in the fall. You may disagree with that. But the idea that it's rigged, the idea that somehow they are going against what they've been saying for months is just not true. And if they really do believe it, you can actually push it the other way and say, if you really believe that Bernie Sanders cannot be the nominee because it's going to hurt people down ballot, then what are you going to do about it? You can't just sit on the sidelines and let Bernie Sanders get a huge, almost insurmountable lead after Super Tuesday. You got to act, and you got to act now. I think it's entirely consistent.
Okay, so Bill and James, I'm channeling the callers that we often get who are supporters of Bernie Sanders here saying, okay, that's a lot of saying he shouldn't be the nominee, and he's going to be bad, and he's going to make people lose down-ticket races.
I don't know. I don't accept the premise. I'm just giving their argument.
You're right. So I guess two things, and Bill, I'll let you go first. One, He's still the strongest candidate in the race, numbers-wise, right now. And two, what's sort of the strategy of the Democratic Party? I know it's early yet. Our caller reminded us that it's early to be discounting Elizabeth Warren, for example. But say this thing does sew up for Bernie Sanders. What's the strategy in the general at that point?
Well, I think right now what the voters I talked to today and also some of the elected officials who are deciding what to do themselves. There was an elected official, Dan Hunt, in our neighborhood who was with Deval Patrick. He's not a Bernie Sanders voter. He came out for Joe Biden yesterday. And I think what they're all starting to think about, and I would label these as moderate Dems definitely, are, you know, I think they are afraid that this could be leading to a brokered convention. I don't think anyone thinks this is over tonight by any means. Joe Biden's momentum has really kicked in over the weekend. So I think that there is a growing anxiety among Democrats I talk to here that they're concerned that could be a disaster. One person who's notable that we haven't talked about yet is Mayor Marty Walsh. He didn't come out for a candidate, and I think that's an indicator not only of his split decision. I think he would either be with Warren or with Biden. By the way, he's not publicly with either one. That says a lot for the mayor of the capital city here in Massachusetts to essentially sit this one out. It's I think an indicator of where we are at the moment. There's a lot of votes to come in, to your caller's point, and even some major elected officials are sitting back to wait to see what that tells us tonight.
All right, let's take a couple more calls. We've got Marilyn on the line from Newton. Marilyn, go ahead.
Well, thank you. I wanted to say that I listened to Biden's speech, and I was really very surprised and somewhat shocked and very dismayed that immediately the whole rest of the Democratic Party jumped on, oh, he's our candidate. I listened to that speech. It was an excellent speech. It was all slogans about what he's going to do, what he's going to do. We heard no plans. We heard no emphasis on a direction. That was number one.
Marilyn, I'm just going to take number one only because our lines are full up and I want to make sure to get more than one caller. Thank you for that. And we will address it. I also want to put Dave on the line from Roslindale. Dave, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering what to think of the effect of early voting is going to be for people who already voted before the announcements over the weekend. I know quite a few people who voted early. I'm guessing a lot of their votes aren't going to really matter. I just wonder how much that's going to play into tonight.
All right, thanks for that, Dave. And actually, I'm going to take these in reverse order. James, what is the I've heard so many people say in the last couple of days, like Dave, wow, this early voting thing has really complicated the situation we're in.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a huge argument for early voting. It's believed that it can increase voter turnout. This is the one very big example where you should not early vote if you can all avoid it. This is the presidential primary where things are moving. In the general election this fall, you know the candidates. You probably know your decision. That's fine. This is not that case. The net effect to the answer to the question is this is good for Bernie Sanders. Any person who voted early, it's good for Bernie Sanders. Obviously, he has had an operation in a number of states, particularly in California, where 20% of the vote is already in, by the way, to get out his people for the early vote. So that's one plus. The second plus for him is that they are disproportionately going to mess up Joe Biden's momentum, right? If anyone who voted for Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar or anyone who voted not for Joe Biden, who they now think if you're a moderate is the choice, if that's the case, the net effect for early voting is to help Bernie Sanders.
OK. And Bill Forey, we heard Marilyn from Newton say, I am not sold yet. You know, she not a big fan of what she heard from Joe Biden in that last big speech he gave. We've got callers saying, you know, don't discount Elizabeth Warren. So let's take four people: Biden, Bloomberg, Warren, and Sanders. What is a message that any one of the four of them could bring forward in the next few weeks that might unify the party behind one candidate at the convention?
Listen, I think what Biden did well last night and over the weekend was to really channel his connection to Barack Obama. That's the big endorsement that's out there, right? And it's likely to go to him. Let's be honest, if he's still in the game, closing on the convention, and that's a card that needs to be played, I think you're going to see it rolled out. He keeps using the Obama-Biden-Democrat mantra. I think, actually, and the voters I talk to today oftentimes brought it up, that Barack Obama is still, to them, the leader of this party. And until somebody else is nominated this year, obviously it was Hillary Clinton last time, but Obama is still ringing out. And that definitely helps Biden in the South. It'll help him, I think, in communities here in Boston as well today.
Okay, I want to make sure to get at least one Bernie caller voice in before we end this segment. Nicholas, you are up from Linfield, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi. Yes, I am a Bernie supporter. I've been voting Democrat with the Democratic Party for the last 20 years. I've been here in Boston. I've been living here for about 30 years, but since I became citizen.
And why are you supporting Biden now, Nicholas? Sanders now, Nicholas.
No, I'm supporting Sanders because you guys should give the guy a chance. You spread a lot of fear mongering the same way as the Republicans do. And that's a guy that, at least if you guys talk about his accomplishments throughout the years, people can understand.
Okay, we're going to take it from you there. So what about accomplishments, lists of accomplishments and what they carry in this race right now, James?
Well, that's not what we're voting on. Let's be clear.
Bill, do you agree?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
That's right. This is aspirational at this point, but exactly. It does. I mean, look, it does matter. They all have that, though. They all of these candidates are well suited for this, and it's an excellent field of candidates. I think that's why there is such split decisions going on, and that to the earlier point about whether early voting is a good idea in a primary like this, the answer is no. Voters keep bringing it up to us today. They wish that they had. Not some of them. There was only 13,000 early votes in Boston, but still, those are votes that can't be recast.
All right, let me give it to James for a last word here.
It's going to be very quick. Bernie Sanders, for all the talk about he can't win, yada, 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 he right now is the most likely person to be the Democratic nominee. He has the most, he doesn't have the best path, he doesn't have an obvious path, but he has the most obvious path, if that makes any sense, versus any other Democrat right now.
All right, that is Boston Globe reporter James Pindle. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And at the WBUR Dorchester Bureau, Bill Forey, editor and publisher of the Dorchester Reporter. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks.
And stay tuned tonight to WBUR for our live coverage of as the polls come back from Super Tuesday. Meanwhile, stay tuned. There's more ahead. We will take your calls and questions on the coronavirus. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. With cases of the novel coronavirus on the rise, we have a lot of questions, and we figured you probably do too. And it seems like for every answer, there are a dozen new questions. So we asked a couple of experts to join us and try to answer our questions and yours. On the line are Lenny Marcus, founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And we also have Dr. Shira Doron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Welcome, Dr. Doron.
Thanks for having me.
And how about you? What questions do you have about the coronavirus, listeners, and how to prepare? What precautions have you already taken? Are you concerned about having to stay home from work? Or are you and your kids having to stay home from school? What's on your mind? What do you want to know? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, so to our panelists, I often start some of these big issues with a simple question, which is, how big of a deal is it? And I have already asked that question a couple of times in the last week on other segments, but things are changing so fast. So Lenny, let me start with you. How big a deal is this?
Well, actually, that's a really good question. And the key word in your question is. Right now, there are about 105 cases in the country. I say about because it's changing as we speak. There have been 9 deaths. Back in late January, we had 5 cases in the country. So it's moving pretty slowly right now. The question, and I think that the more important question, is what will it be? We don't know for sure. However, the time is ripe now to prepare for the possibility that it will be much bigger, that it will affect our community, and that each and every one of us should be ready to do whatever is necessary should it hit us.
Okay, and so bear with me, Dr. Doron, on one more sort of oversimplified question. But on a scale of concerning to terrifying, how contagious is novel coronavirus, and where do we find ourselves on that scale?
Well, I mean, it's pretty contagious. It's more contagious than flu, it seems. It's not nearly as contagious as measles. Experts use a measurement called R-naught, and it ranks about a 2 to 3, where something like measles, which is an airborne virus, and this is not an airborne virus, is along the lines of on the order of about 18. So that's where it falls in terms of contagiousness.
So then let me ask one more question before we turn to some callers. COVID-19 and novel coronavirus and COVID-19. Which comes first and what's the relationship between those two? Because we hear those terms tossed around a lot.
The COVID-19 was a term that was adopted by the World Health Organization and other organizations to simplify what we call this case. Novel coronavirus is generically what this scenario would be called, and this specific outbreak is being called COVID-19.
And that's when you have the actual disease. Is that right, Dr. Daron?
COVID-19 is a disease. The virus is being referred to as SARS-CoV-2.
Okay. And is there a possibility that one might get the virus but not wind up with the disease?
Yeah, there is a possibility that you could be exposed to the virus, that you could even have a positive test for the virus. I would say there's more than a possibility. We know that people have tested positive for the virus and not developed symptomatic disease. It's interesting to see how small a percentage children are, for example, out of the total number that have been symptomatically infected. They probably are having the same exposures as the adult patients, but perhaps not manifesting disease. That does not necessarily translate into a major source of transmission, though.
Okay, let's start taking some calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Isaiah, you are on with Lenny Marcus and Dr. Shira Daron. Isaiah's calling from I-95. What's your question, Isaiah?
Yes, I'm calling because I know it's always been reported how many people have gotten the coronavirus and have died from it, but no one's ever reporting how many people have survived from the coronavirus and have gone through the regular illness procedures like the regular common cold. Can you talk about that?
Thanks for that. Which of our panelists can take that?
Dr. Daron, you take that one.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so, I mean, what we're seeing is we're seeing the number of cases and we're seeing the number of deaths, and certainly we can calculate the percentage of deaths as a proportion of the number of cases. And we're seeing overall percentages somewhere in the range of 2%. Case fatality rate. However, it's really important to note a couple of things. One is that depending on what area, what country, what province in China, for example, you look at, that number is pretty different. And the other is that early in any outbreak, especially a new pathogen like this, the death rates that are seen, that are reported, that are calculated, overestimate the true fatality of the disease. And the reason for that is that early in the recognition of a new infection, you're going to have only the patients that are sickest presenting for care and being tested for the new infection. And so you're going to see that case fatality rate as a proportion of sick people, not as a proportion of all the people. I think that what we're going to see over time, and as we are able to increase testing capacity, for example, when we have commercially available tests and any doctor can order it, is that if you look at all of the patients, the mildly ill ones, maybe even the asymptomatic ones, that case fatality rate, that mortality is going to go lower and lower and lower, and maybe even approach the mortality rate that we're very accustomed to from influenza every winter. And this infection may not in the end be all that different from flu.
All right, let's take another call. We've got Robert on the line from Woburn. Robert, go ahead. What's your question?
I have to drive from Boston to Syracuse a lot, and it's a long drive, and I have to stop at the roadside rests, and some of them are pretty dirty, and what am I supposed to do?
Great question. And Lenny, I'm going to turn that to you and not only ask you if you can answer Robert from Woburn's question, but also what should people who are responsible for the sort of the cleaning and presentation of those kinds of rest stops, et cetera, be doing to make sure that Robert's safe?
Well, that's a good question. And all of us, for every place we go, should be very focused on cleaning. We should also remember that the virus, the pathogen, will get into us through our mouth. So there, it's a good idea not to put your hands to your mouth, to keep your hands very clean, very frequent hand washing. And if you're seeing a place that is dirty, watch out. This has particular concern for us right now. Be careful when touching doorknobs. Be careful when you're on a plane with the tray. All of these places are where the virus could exist, and we could get that virus by touching one of those places where someone before who has had the disease has coughed and there are droplets. We touch that. We touch our face. That's how we can get the disease.
So, Lenny,
so cleanliness is going to be critical.
So should people be carrying around like hand sanitizer in their vehicles and in their purses or briefcases? Is it that level of sort of constantly trying to make sure you're staying clean?
Yes. We're not there today. There are very few cases today. However, as the numbers of cases increase and the possibility that we will come close to someone who has one of those cases, as that evolves, yes, that is what we should all be doing.
Okay, our lines keep filling up. Every time I take a call, another one's coming right in. So let's get Karen. Karen's calling from Nashua. What's your question for Lenny Marcus and Dr. Durome?
Hi. So my 13-year-old daughter has cystic fibrosis, and I'm curious what would happen if she contracted this, considering she's already got a respiratory disease.
Let's turn to Dr. Durome for that.
Yeah, so on the one hand, she's got one thing that puts her at higher risk for severe disease, which is her immune-compromising condition, or particularly her chronic lung disease. And people with chronic diseases like lung disease have been seen to have more severe illness. But her young age is protective. And in all of the case series and all of the reports, particularly the largest clusters of patients from China, what we're seeing is that a very tiny proportion of the patients with COVID-19 are children, and that children have milder disease. They tend not to develop difficulty with oxygenation. They tend to resolve their fever very quickly. So those two factors might balance out her risk.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are taking your calls on Radio Boston about coronavirus, and we have with us Lenny Marcus, founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, which is a joint program of the T.H. Chan School of Public Health at Harvard, and Dr. Sheila Durome, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Todd is on the line from Cranston, Rhode Island. Todd, what's your question?
Hi, how are you? My question is that I'm seeing in the news that, you know, it can affect older people mainly. I'm also seeing that children can possibly be a host for this and maybe not carry the, I mean, catch the disease, but maybe be a host to carry it and pass it along to the adults. Is there any truth to this that I'm reading in the news?
Thanks for that, Todd. Dr. Durome, I'm going to give that one to you.
Yeah, the first part of your question regarding older people, we are definitely seeing that the older you are, the more likely you are to have severe complications or even die from the disease. The younger you are, the less likely you are to manifest any symptoms of the disease. We do know that anybody could have a positive test without symptoms, and especially children, because they don't seem to manifest many symptoms at all. What role they play in the transmission, though, is still an unanswered scientific question. I think it is possible that if you have virus in your respiratory tract and you don't have symptoms, you might be able to transmit that. But if you think about the transmission characteristics of the disease, it's transmitted via the droplet route. That means you're coughing or sneezing out large droplets of fluid, mucus, and that's generally how these types of viruses infect other people. If you're not coughing or sneezing, there's really just going to be that much less of a chance that you could give it to somebody else.
All right, let's keep going. Andy, you are on the line with Lenny Marcus and Dr. Sheila Durome. Andy's calling from Pittsfield, Massachusetts. What's your question, Andy?
Yes, the wear of the mask. I keep getting conflicting opinions. Is it worth it? Is it protection or not?
Lenny.
It said that if you have the disease, it's protection because if you cough, that mucus that Dr. Durome just mentioned will be held in. It's also being said that it is not protective in and of itself. And Dr. Doron, I'd be interested in your opinion on this as well.
Yeah, we're not recommending masks to any of our patients. We're not recommending that our staff wear masks in their day-to-day life. We're asking people not to take masks home. We're asking people not to go to stores and buy up the masks that are really needed by the hospitals. They're not recommended by our Centers for Disease Control as a measure to protect you against respiratory infections in general. And it's largely... for a number of reasons, but the lay public is not trained in how to don and doff, put on and take off masks in a safe way. Those masks can be contaminated on the outside by respiratory viruses, and in taking them off and handling them, you may actually be making things worse. Here in the hospital, we use those masks to protect us against respiratory viruses, but we use them for one patient at a time just during those patient care interactions, and then we throw them out, and that's not how you would be using them out in the world.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Christina from Townsend, what's your question?
Hi there. I, you know, 10 or so years ago had H1N1 flu.
Wow.
And of course, you know, got better. And I just can't remember, like, on a nationwide level and, you know, world level, how it passes. Like, what, how does this end?
Lenny, do you have a thought on that?
Well, it's not known exactly how this will end, and every disease is different. In the ideal world, we'll be able to contain it. Fewer and fewer people will be contracting the disease, which means fewer people are moving it to others. It's been thought, the possibility that as the summer months come and it's warmer here, that the disease will have a harder time transmitting from one person to another. H1N1 is very different than COVID-19. So as we have more experience with this particular disease, we'll have a better sense about when it will end. It eventually, just like H1N1, it will end. We just don't know when and how.
Before I take another call, Dr. Doron, I want to turn to you there because I know you've done some thinking about this question of how seasonal this disease is, and I wonder if you could talk a little more about that.
Yeah, I think it's still a little bit hard to predict. We know that some viruses, you know, are seasonal and they come and go, more prevalent in the winter, less prevalent in the summer, although even influenza we occasionally get cases of in the summer. You know, it shifts from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere. Other viruses kind of persist throughout the year. Others are more prevalent in other times, like late summer, for example, for certain viruses. I think, you know, with this one having started in the winter, it really remains to be seen. We have, as an example, we have the MERS virus, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, which never really became very seasonal. So I think, you know, we should be prepared for the possibility that it will simply persist.
All right, let's take one more call. Martha from Watertown, what's your question?
Hi, I live in a condominium complex that has a common HVAC system. And I was wondering, given what happened on the cruise ship, has anybody put together any guidelines that should someone become infected in the building and is asked to be quarantined, how that would work in a building like mine?
It's a great question. And Lenny, I'm going to turn to you and also ask you the prevention question on that one again, too.
I'm going to acknowledge that I haven't seen advice on what to do within a building yet. Cruise ship is a much more contained atmosphere than a building. But that's a really good question and something that we should be pursuing. I don't have the answer to that.
Dr. Doron, have you heard anything that Lenny hasn't heard?
Since it is not a virus transmitted by airborne route, I would expect that there would not be transmission via HVAC systems. And I don't believe that public health authorities have been removing confirmed cases or patients under or persons under quarantine from their buildings, even in the case of shared HVAC systems.
Okay, Lenny, in sort of our last 15 seconds for each of you, what is the key message that you want to get out to listeners today?
Key message is get prepared to be quarantined. There were 14 firefighters out in Seattle who had exposure to the person who had disease. They were put into a 2-week quarantine. So prepare yourself to be quarantined. What would you do? Have the food, have the procedures, go through the drill with your friends and your family.
And that means food, medications, that kind of thing, right, Lenny?
All of your essentials. So know that you're going to be out of the loop. You're not going to work. You could perhaps commute via tele connections. But imagine what it would be like for you to be out of the loop for 2 weeks and prepare yourself for that eventuality.
Okay, in 15 seconds, Dr. Tarone, your big message?
I would say preparedness is good. Panic is not good. There's no need to panic. We're all going to be fine.
Okay. Lenny Marcus of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Shira Durone of an infectious disease physician at Tufts Medical Center, thanks.
Thank you.
Hey, stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it is still Super Tuesday, that day where Massachusetts is one of 14 states and one territory participating in the Democratic primary. Here is some of what WBUR has been hearing from voters today.
I voted for Biden. I myself am a Republican, but I did do the Democrat ballot. He is more right-wing than most people.
As I saw her plans and I saw her on the campaign trail, I became full in for Warren.
I was going to vote for Warren, but unfortunately it sounds like she's losing speed, so I decided to try my best. I'm not really psyched about Biden, so I gave my vote to Bernie, and hopefully that will be enough.
Trump. I think he made the country better. So, and I'm a veteran, and he's good to the veterans.
I voted for Bernie Sanders. He represents what are closer to Democratic values than any of the other candidates.
I voted for William Weld. I whatever chance he has, I suppose.
We've been checking in with reporters around the state, and joining us now from Springfield is New England Public Radio's Berkshire reporter Nancy Cohen. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you.
So, Nancy, you visited a senior center in West Springfield, Morgan Elementary in Holyoke, and St. Paul's Church Parish in Holyoke. Tell us about what the mood's been like.
Well, I sensed a real feeling of enthusiasm, a feeling of possibility. A lot of voters expressed that there was a candidate who they felt could help make their communities better, their lives better, even the country better. You know, a lot of people talked about the need for change, the need for what they called good government, better government. I spoke to a wide variety of people, an 89-year-old nun, a 32-year-old woman who identified herself as a Latina, two brothers in their 20s, a lot of people coming out to vote, and a 59-year-old man named Kayem. He's a barber. He lives in Holyoke. He did vote at the church, and for him, the big issues were both economic and equity.
Raising minimum wage, raising the wages so that men and women are equally paid the same, and also addressing the historical toxic residues of racism. Because in order to move the country forward, we got to realize we're all Americans, period, in the story.
And Nancy, just briefly, what's turnout been like out there?
It's been 10 to 12% in Holyoke and West Springfield this afternoon. Kind of average.
And any surprises or anything you haven't expected to see that you did?
You know, I was just really touched about the way people talked about the need for people from different backgrounds to come together. And it was expressed kind of across the board by a number of people. Including one voter. I don't know if we have time for this tape.
Yeah, go ahead.
Drake Descant. Drake is a 40-year-old man. He owns a music school in Holyoke. He came to vote with his 12-year-old son, Billy, and his car was covered with Bernie Sanders stickers.
Bernie Sanders all the way. You know, so many people in this country don't have health care or have health care that's just gouging their pockets. If Medicare for All is a thing that happens, the country in general is just going to become healthier.
New England Public Radio's Berkshire reporter Nancy Cohen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally on this Super Tuesday, we want to take a moment to highlight the people who will make today work around Massachusetts, and that's the poll workers and volunteers. Dennis DeMello is a volunteer at the Veronica Smith Senior Center, a polling station in Brighton, and he has been passionate about helping out on Election Day for the last 11 years.
I love it. It gets me out, and I just turned 80 last November. And I think this is what keeps me going.
Dennis sees voting as a great unifier and loves seeing people get out and actively engaging with each other in our democracy.
I think the main thing was that we all become one because we're all human. As I would say in my days, you and me put our pants on one leg at a time, no different. That's it.
Dennis, thank you. And thanks to all of you at polling places today making sure that this special Democratic endeavor of ours goes smoothly. And if you haven't voted, you still have time. Polls close at 8 p.m. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.